going to continue for but the three bills, I think, will go kind of fast, but I'd like to continue on the fraud issue that we've been working on for a while. And what we all know, it's a huge cost to the consumers in our in this country, in the state of Minnesota. And we're going to, I'll say it again, we're planning on some kind of a board or something or a working group this summer, really dig into this stuff and find out where we can close some loopholes in the Minnesota Senate, the Minnesota House, and the state of Minnesota. But it's too much, I think, right now to chew off in the next month or two. But we are going to be honestly looking at the fraud the health community and other areas, and auto and what have you. So with that, I think we'll continue on that discussion a little bit with Carl Hammersburg from SAS. And I asked what SAS means, and somebody said it doesn't mean a thing. So, but anyway, Mr. Hammerstein, Hammersburg, you may identify yourself for the tape and start the discussion.
Thank you very much, Chair Mattson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Carl Hammersburg. I'm a government fraud solutions specialist with SAS, which at one point in time stood for Statistical Analytical System, but at this point is just the word SAS. Had an opportunity to work with the company for a little over a year now, working in a number of different states, as well as some of our neighbors to the north in Canada, having a good chance to take a look at fraud from many different angles. Particularly how the government works with it, and often how government and private companies come together around things in the insurance industry. Prior to that, I spent 21 years working in Washington State, 19 of which was in workers' compensation. Had an opportunity to take a look at it from the view of a regulator as well as the view of the insurer. So that's really a little bit of where my background comes in. Had a chance to listen to some of the very excellent testimony that you had last Monday. I don't have any stories about Lamborghinis for you today, though. So for any of you that caught that last week, this may be a little bit drier. With that, I want to just jump in a little bit. You definitely had already heard from folks last week, and so I wanted to keep this brief around some of the statistics that are out there. A number of different ones. Just looking at healthcare, you know, comprehensively, that fraud at this point in the United States may be running between $125 and $175 billion a year, and that's actually from a few years ago. The numbers have been rising dramatically, and that really represents almost 20% of all the waste within the system. A shocking number for me, and there's quite a few other angles of this in terms of studies, is when the Coalition Against Insurance Fraud did a study of consumers, talking to U.S. adults, 20% are actually saying it's acceptable to defraud insurance companies. That's a stunning number, because they really just don't see the fact that it takes a toll on everybody and it increases the cost for themselves and for other people, for other consumers. 55% said that poor service would increase their own personal likelihood to commit insurance fraud against their insurer. So again, this idea that it's just acceptable. And I know you heard from the NICB last week, but just dramatic that the number of questionable claims, so that's the ones that already are being identified as being a potential problem, jumped nearly 27% in just 2 years. So the problem is bad, it's getting worse. All right, you heard a lot of that already, so I don't want to focus on that. I realize that in your role, you're really looking at it potentially from three angles. One is some of the underlying legal structure, you know, taking a look at the no-fault rules in the state, what's working for you as well as what isn't working for you. And you have an opportunity to not only look at it from Minnesota's experiences, but look at other states that are either following that no-fault route, the PIP route, or following others. Other opportunities there are to really look at what are the penalties that are in place. At times, one of the things we did in Washington was even look at the definitions of fraud. General definitions versus ones that were very specific to certain lines of insurance, so that you could really work up a case better and get that accepted.
Did we take it all away?
The second piece is really looking at whether or not there's the resources to be able to take those on. I know that the folks may not have said this themselves, but Department of Commerce, the county prosecutors, I know that they're experiencing resource constraints. It's the same place, the same way it looks everywhere. And often it's constraints, do I work this particular case or something else?
Mr. Hammerstein, Hammerberg,
yes.
On the health fraud costs of $125 billion
yes.
to the ratepayers and to society, what would be fair to say? Just a guesstimate, like $3 or $5 billion of that would be in the state of Minnesota, a guesstimate?
Yes.
I mean, it's all, you yes. know, three I mean, to five billion just to
given,
hear.
I was going to say, given the size of Minnesota, I would say that you're probably looking at between five and seven.
Billion for the ratepayers and
each,
the fraud
each year.
In this state.
Each year. This is talking about annually. Now, that's across all health care. So, but really, at the end of the day, you know, virtually all health care, I mean, that is insurance. You know, whether we're talking about it directly through, let's say, the accident and the no-fault, but once they've tapped out that no-fault fund, now it's hitting back on other insurers. And there's a ton of fraud and waste that's going on within the rest of the health insurers directly. We work a lot with health insurer, with health care companies, health care providers, as well as insurers. So we've had a chance to take a look at that from both perspectives. And it's really amazing when you put the data together across those various areas. If you take that step, now you can start to see, here's a provider that might have looked reasonable if just one insurer looked at it. Okay, you know, here's how much they're billing us for. Once you see that across many different insurers, you realize they're billing for 40 or 50 hours a day, more hours than exist. But it's really trying to get that broader view, and that's one of the things that really is a tough constraint for people.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. And so that was really what I wanted to focus on today, was that idea of looking at things from a data sharing perspective, from a detection perspective, and really trying to talk about how we've worked with things, some stuff that I've done in my past with the state, as well as some things that SAS has done with many customers around a continuous monitoring system. Wanted to give a few examples and then dive in a little bit deeper. So one of them, and so in some cases we can't specify exactly who we worked with because of a non-disclosure agreement, so work with me on the first case example. It was a private auto insurer, and we were working specifically around PIP fraud. We took initially 18 months of their historical data and about 100,000 claims that could have been questionable. Layered on the data from the National Insurance Crime Bureau and the ISO, so you had other claims data in there. From that, what we found was an 85% hit rate on claims that would be questionable, that could be abuse or fraud, and a 98% hit rate when you looked at providers, particularly at provider networks. This idea that there's multiple people involved, it's a more active scheme, this isn't just some extra billing, there's a lot going on here. And that showed over $70 million worth of savings with that one. Second example, and this one I can name, is some work that we've been doing very recently with CNA as an insurer. They are actually stepping in to three different areas, the auto, along with workers' comp and general liability. Initial pilot with them, looking at the fraud detection methods they already had in place. So they already had systems in place, but we were able to easily show an additional $23 million there with them. Right now, what they're expecting is a return on investment of $33 for every dollar spent in going this route by the second year. And that's something that really magnifies over time. And they were looking, one of the things they were concerned with is they knew that there were medical provider networks, these actual really fraudulent networks out there. They were hitting them, but they hadn't done a good job of finding them, except after the fact. You start an investigation on one, and then you might be able to find that there was a breakout. One of the things that they identified, they said, in the first year, we want to find 12 of those big networks because they're worth so much money. We found 60 in the first 9 months. There was so much more there than they ever knew before. And the third one is my own personal experience from Washington State within workers' comp. One of the things we were able to do there was pull together data from many different programs. So we cut across five different state agencies along with some federal data. The result of that was that each investigation after we put the system in place was able to return 50% more dollars than they had previously. There's a 76% hit rate in terms of being in the right place, identifying the right places, and that's continually going up. So it's been in place for about 18 months in total, and the rate continues to go up. $34 million return already at this point, and they're expecting a much more significant return over time. So,
you know, as far as I know, there's still only 24 hours in a day, right?
That's correct.
And
while I've tried to work 23 or 24 of those, even that gets tiring after a while.
Well, they're billing sometimes for 42, 45 hours a
day. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. It's absolutely amazing. And sometimes that's what's hidden when you only look at it from a single data point.
Senator Carlson, did you have a...
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hammersburg, on the CNA example you have there, you said that you identified 60 medical provider fraud networks. Is that... What's the region we're talking about here? Or is this the state?
No. It wasn't. It was not just a single state. That was looking more broadly than that. They did a couple of geographic areas, and I don't know exactly how many states that covered in total within the initial piece. I could get that for you.
Okay. Yeah. And then you mentioned in example number one, that there was a personal injury protection fraud and over $70 million identified. What's the region of that one?
That was just in Florida.
Just in Florida. Okay.
I'm just thinking if we ever do this working group, not if we ever do it, I think we're going to do it, we should have you or somebody from your staff kind of help us out what you've done in other states and that. I think the input would be very valuable to this working group we're going to set up on the general area of fraud. So we'd like you to be somebody participant. Senator Carl.
Another question, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And Mr. Hammersburg, you mentioned somewhere around $6 billion in the state of Minnesota?
Yes, just in healthcare.
And what percent of the total billings would that be? You know, we're talking about an insurance industry that has a certain sales or a certain billings. What percent is that?
Typically that runs about 10%. In some cases, it can be down in the single digits. I've seen some other places or other studies where it's run as high as 15 or 20. So I'll give you the benefit of the doubt and say you're probably middle of the road and around 10. Since you are working on this, you are paying attention to it.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Okay, continue.
And to your request, Chair Mattson, we would love to participate in that. If I'm available, I would certainly be ready and willing to sit down and help. Or if not, I have a couple of very good counterparts. I've really enjoyed the opportunity to work with other states, and we would definitely love to do the same with you.
Okay, thank you.
So one of the ways that we approach it is really thinking about the people, the issues that you're looking at in terms of buckets. There's improper payments, low-level abuse, a little bit of fraud, is people inflating some claims, other issues going on that are there. And that's very opportunistic. It includes mistakes, things like that. Then you start to move to the middle of the spectrum. You start to look at criminal offenders. Here's people who have actively sort of made a decision that they're going to do this, they're going to commit a crime. They're typically not connected with other folks. It might be a one-time thing. It may be a pattern of behavior over time. Then the third group is what you heard a lot about last week, which is really this idea of organized criminal gangs. So that truly is a lot of people working together. They're recruiting people to stage accidents. They're recruiting people to send them to specific attorneys, to specific medical providers, and really create this entire network of billing that will keep generating money over time. When you think about them in those categories, and then we think about the way that we actually try to look for the problems. The traditional ways with looking at things are really around business rules. And business rules can really help find, some of the regular problems, but they're not going to find the organized crime. They're not going to find people that have learned the rules, that have learned the matches and the thresholds. That was, in fact, some of what we uncovered in my state, is we found people that had figured out exactly what our rule was around the things that we matched, and they followed that pattern perfectly. But when we looked them to see if there was an anomaly there, it was the behavior that had them just following the rules perfectly, always. Every time the rule changed, they changed to just match it. That behavior was so impossible, it made them stand out compared to their peers. Start to look at them from that perspective. And then it's taking a look at it with predictive models, looking at all the cases we've done before and finding out what are the deep elements of those and how do we start to identify those very early. The idea here is not about what's known as pay and chase. Don't let the money go out the door and then try to get it afterwards. It's how do you protect yourself early on and say, here's someone that's questionable from the very beginning, or here's a provider that's starting to bill in a very questionable manner early on so the money hasn't all left the door. It's really about protecting the entire system. And the last piece is really trying to layer on networks, that idea of trying to look at them more comprehensively. And I'm going to come back to that one in just a second here. So thinking about that in terms of social networks, the idea here is that it's building out, looking at people more than one at a time. And I want to make sure to avoid some confusion because of the terminology here. By that, I'm not talking about Facebook and things like that, as in social networking and Twitter. However, those can be some great places to make connections between people. Because if you supposedly have no connection and you're a witness to an accident, yet you are connected on Facebook, now we start to see that that's one way that you could be networked. As taking a look at it from the perspective of how are these people tied together with referrals to different providers, with prescriptions and where those go, with witnesses and the claims that are coming in, and what is it that's connecting them? And it could be the addresses, phone numbers, an IP address off of the computers where they're doing filings of claims from, witnesses, the bank account numbers, and pulling all that together to say, here's one where it's not a single claim. It's not just a single provider. There's 30 or 40 people involved here, and you need to look at them completely from the beginning. Look at that whole network. That really lets investigators do something far different than they have in the past, and it speeds up that work dramatically from the beginning. So I wanted to kind of show you a little bit of thinking about how it is today. So you might have a single medical provider, and they're interacting with many different insurance companies. There also may be some information about them in Medicaid because they're also billing there. There's some tax information about them, any connections with the Department of Commerce if they've taken a look at things. But right now, each one of those sits in a silo with their own data. They may have their own fraud detection systems in place in an investigative unit. And the idea is if you start to think about it more from a consortium standpoint, that we are all in this together, then you can pull data together across those various entities. You can take that role that the regulator has and start to begin to pull that information together and say, you know, I now know something different about you by pulling together how you were billing these seven different entities as well as some other state data than I knew before. If you put together a comprehensive detection system at that point, it really starts to leverage not only what Commerce can do in terms of running with criminal cases, but there's the opportunity also to work back directly with the insurers. What that does is it starts to reduce the barriers between those various investigative units. If three insurers know that the same person is the problem, then they can start to talk about something a little bit differently in terms of how they do an investigation or how they do an audit. And then that actually can feed back into sort of the business areas, so they're making decisions on things where everything doesn't have to become an investigation or an audit. That was really where I saw some huge gains in Washington, was not just some of the numbers I gave you before of how do we get better if we were going to investigate somebody, get to the right case at the right time, but actually putting things back in the business area so they were making better decisions sooner and, again, stop the money from going out the door. It's cost avoidance rather than pay and chase.
Senator Goodwin, did you have a question about
this? Yes, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to figure out, with all this information sharing going on, you've got to have issues around data privacy. Or there should be if there's not.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, that's something that we regularly deal with. So I want to give you two examples. One is that we've done this very successfully with sort of with an enterprise view of government to government. So many different government agencies coming together, even with all the restrictions around data. So we're talking HIPAA data on medical stuff. We're talking tax restrictions, all those kinds of things. Yet we've managed to work now with five different states around how do you deal with those things and just use it for the purposes very specifically of determining fraud and abuse and protect that data so that it is both secure and that it doesn't go out to any other entity. A second thing that we've done is with two states, we're working now around workers' compensation specifically. So I know that your concerns are broader than that. That's why I really wanted to talk about all types of insurance. But often the regulators are just looking at something really specific. And there I've actually seen some law changes to bring in enhanced data to the regulator just with that whole purpose of how does the regulator do a better job of investigating cases and finding the right places to go, but also is there a way that they can actually help the private insurers with their own case? In other words, giving them a lead on someone where they already had all the information. Definitely data protection, data privacy is a big deal with that. We even host some things, so we've been through all the rules and restrictions, even with the IRS level security and those types of things. And so, yes, I agree with you. That's something that is definitely a big concern, and particularly with insurers themselves, because one of the things they're also concerned with is not only the privacy of the data that they have on their consumers, or the medical providers, but also the competitive information. You know, so you're not revealing that to everybody else and really opening up the market in a way that it wasn't supposed to, or that you're violating antitrust laws.
Is that a good one?
Within an insurance company, there are multiple people, I imagine, that have access to information on the consumers that you're dealing with. That's quite a bit different than the medical field in that they have to protect the data on health records, for example, and nobody can look into those records without specific authorization to do that. And if they do, they get fired. But with the amount of people that have access in all these different companies to private data, that concerns me because I've looked at all the different insurance companies and banks and trusts that have had data stolen, hundreds of thousands of names stolen and information and social securities by individuals. But now we've got a network where it's not only that the people within that agency, but it's people in all of those different or company, but it's people in all those different companies that can share that data.
So to that, I would point out a couple of things. One of our very specific approaches and something that I did and in Washington is around very, very tight role-based security. So there's even places like, for example, due to the sensitivity of some of the IRS data that we had, there were only three people that could even access that, could even view that. It couldn't go anywhere else. It couldn't go out over the internet. It couldn't go anywhere else. So that's one approach, is very much locking things down. I had investigators and auditors who sat on different rows. Some could have access to certain types of data because of what they did, and others, you know, had access to a completely different data set and they couldn't share within them. What I would say is one of the other things that we're doing now is actually helping others around issues like the data breach that you're talking about. For example, South Carolina just last fall ended up experiencing a data breach of 2.6 million records around taxpayers. At this point, they honestly don't even know what the plan. I mean, there haven't been a rash of identity thefts, and they've spent a lot of money trying to prevent that and give people protections around things, you know, but once it's out there, it's out there. At this point, they haven't seen the huge rash of it, but that is the concern and the expectation that could happen. That's another place where we are a trusted provider around solutions around that type of cybersecurity. A third thing that I would say is that idea of, you know, you're concerned if the data all comes together, it's everywhere. And in fact, it could be just restricting that piece to really to the Department of Commerce, to a very limited set of people, with the opportunity then, if you provide data back, it's not revealing the same level of things. You can give them a lead without providing all the data. That's often how we've worked with other agencies and other entities to say, here's someone you want to take a look at. We can't really tell you all the data of why you want to look at them, but you may still want to do an investigation around them.
Stay tuned.
Well, I'm not comfortable with the data practices that insurance industry right now.
I'm trying to work through a lot of these issues, but go ahead, continue on.
Okay. So with that, really, and this is just following up on exactly what we were talking about, is that idea to say you could have potentially have a central role as a regulator with the ability to bring in data from multiple places, from both the insurers, but also layer on some of the other ways in which government sees these same providers, sees these same people, so that you can identify the ones that would be most at risk, the most likely to be committing fraud, and the ones that are, in fact, networked together by taking a look at them from different viewpoints. And then, in addition to Commerce taking on the criminal investigations, civil investigations that they should be doing, there is an opportunity just to enhance what the insurers are doing by really providing them leads back, by saying, here's the ones that really look interesting when you layer on more advanced analytics. You know, a number of insurers are going that route by themselves, but they're not necessarily doing it everywhere. You heard some places geographically based. They're not necessarily doing it across all lines, and they definitely don't have the information when someone's, you know, tapping them in many different places where they're hitting five or six different insurers rather than just one. And, I mean, the values to that, there's a few things. From the perspective for Department of Commerce, it really is about enhanced data and scoring on what they're doing today. So they have, you know, 1,400 referrals that are coming in from the insurers. They have tips and leads that are coming in from the public. You know, how do you best score those and figure out these are the ones we really should be doing an investigation on, and what information can we...
Got music back.
All right, let's go. I've been told to leave many different ways before, but that's a new one. with that, the idea is being able to really enhance, you know, which ones are of the most value, which ones should they be investigating first. It's about that return on investment, time to value, and speeding up investigations. And the second piece is really that ability to build on the networks. After that, it's also the ability to identify fraud and abuse early. That whole idea of switching from the pay and chase to the early detection and really helping save money by not letting it go out the door in the first place, with the opportunity to get the referrals back to the insurers as well, and really starting to address some of the cases appropriately below a criminal level. In other words, don't use tools that are stronger than what's needed for the particular situation. From an insurer perspective, it really it starts to identify more cases than what they would have been able to take a look at initially by enhancing it with some of that cross-insurer policy provider fraud, detects things that would have otherwise been hidden. And while you still have that protection of the coverage data and manage that well. And then the other piece is really an opportunity to help them improve at a lower cost almost than just trying to each one go it alone. That can be very critical for some of the smaller and mid-sized insurers that frankly don't have the funds to invest in doing a good solution themselves. I've seen it. They're really working with very, very basic things like we were many, many years ago. So that was what I was actually coming to present on today. I'm definitely available for other questions.
Maybe that the tips that could be patterned after the turn in poachers, you know, maybe you get a reward or something if you see some things going on and the insurance companies, instead of putting out $2 million, they might give somebody a reward of $10,000 or something. You know, just came to my head right this minute. I don't know if that.
Actually, I've seen that used in a number of states. I have seen that sort of reward system. It can definitely work. It can get you some tips and leads that people aren't already getting. The downside ends up being debates about what the case was worth, or if an insurer or the regulator decides that may not be the best one to work. Now you have a frustrated person feeling like they gave a lead and they're wanting their check back. But it is one of many things that you can and probably should explore as you do that work group.
It's not quite a Metzen original, I take it so. Okay. Thank you. Any further questions, Mr. Hammersburg? Okay, this has been very helpful. Thank you very much. I know you have to catch a plane, at 2:30 or 3 or something?
Yeah, and now.
Okay. Senator Dollar, you ready? Mortgage foreclosure consultant services modification.
We have no slides.
Senator Dahl, do you have a delete all amendment that you'd like to put on the bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to
move the A1 amendment.
Beyond the A1 amendment to get a discussion, you'd like all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Senator Dahl.
Mr. Chair and committee, we have a bill here, Senate File 294. I'll give you a real brief summary of what the bill does, and I'll turn it over to Mr. Ron Elwood to give you some specific examples or more clarification. What this bill does is that it ensures that any person charging a homeowner a fee to obtain a loan modification from a lender complies with all of the requirements of applicable law, which are under Chapter 325N. It also, this bill closes an unintended loophole that exempts loan modification businesses that obtain a Chapter 58, which is mortgage originator servicer license, from disclosures, permitting cancellation, no waiver provisions, and being subject to consumer remedies provisions. So I'll turn it over to Ron Elwood from Legal Aid.
Mr. Elwood, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. Appreciate the opportunity, and thank Senator Dahl for bringing this bill. tried to get around to as many members as possible. I did speak with some on this bill and apologize for the inability to reach everybody before the hearing. It's a pretty simple bill. Several years ago, the Attorney General's office brought some amendments to 325N to address some of the problems with fee-for-service loan modification businesses. Obviously, we have a free state-operated mortgage foreclosure prevention program that can provide help to homeowners to get loan modifications to stay in their homes. There are also private businesses that perform the same service, and certainly they are legal in Minnesota, and homeowners can choose the free service or go for a fee-for-service. They typically charge between $2,000 and $3,000 to get a loan modification. Obviously, if they can help a homeowner stay in their home, whichever way it works, that is the best outcome. However, as I think everyone knows, some of these operators are not always scrupulous, and some folks will just take the money and not provide the service at all. The law was changed a couple of years ago, 325N, to prevent folks from taking money up front. You had to provide you had to perform the contract services, and then you would get paid. And there are a whole other set of protections that Senator Dahl enumerated. There's some contract disclosures, and importantly, most importantly, you can't waive the rights that are under law. What we have started to discover several years ago was a problem. There, in most of these statutes, they're exempt. Businesses, one of the exempt businesses are mortgage originators, and we started to see folks coming to our offices complaining about businesses that were taking the money, but they had obtained from the Department of Commerce Chapter 58 mortgage originator licenses, really not having any intention of originating any mortgages or doing any refinancings, simply to get out of jail card free and not have to comply with the law. This bill simply closes that loophole and says if you, no matter if you have a license or not, simply follow the rules. What I want to be clear about this bill does not do is it does not in any way impact the business practices or operations of any legitimate mortgage originator or servicer. It does not impact their ability to originate loans or operate refinancings. They would not be covered by any of these provisions. It's only if they're in the business of doing loan modifications, and typically those folks are not. These are separate individuals just in the business of loan mod. So I'd be happy to answer any questions, and thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today.
Yeah, I see on the notes here that there's no known opposition, but let's make that clear. Is there anybody in the audience that would like to speak against this Senate file? I see the realtors and others are nodding.
Mr. Chair and members, just to let you know that we have vetted this bill with the Mortgage Brokers Association, Minnesota Mortgage Association, the Minnesota Realtors Association, the Bar Association, and we have let them. We have talked to them about this in advance. Thank you.
So you and Senator Dahl have done your background check on this and your work. So thank you. The only question I have is the council thinks it doesn't have to go anywhere except to the floor, but we're asking Senator Latz to take a look at it. I think it was referred to, if I'm not mistaken, Mr. Elwood, to the civil law division in or committee in the House. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and members,
and
yes.
Do you know why?
Yes, that's correct. Because the remedy section in 325N would be affected, so therefore they did want to take a look at that.
Okay. Senator Dames before Senator Latz. Senator Dames.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Elwood, would you explain, you said earlier in your testimony that there's a loophole in there that can possibly give a loan originator a get-out-of-jail-free card. Would you explain a little more in detail how that works?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Senator Dames, if you look at the delete all in section 1, it would be on line 2.15. This is number 8 in the list of exempt entities would be the residential mortgage originator or servicer. So that means that they don't have to comply with the rest of the provisions of 325N, even though they would actually still be required to comply with the one provision, they couldn't take the money up front. However, there is a provision in 325N that also says that you cannot waive any of your rights. By being an exempt entity under number 8 here on line 2.15, they would not be held to that standard, and then, in fact, they simply ask folks to waive their rights, and they get the money up front. So that is how they can avoid compliance with the fairly minimal requirements that are existing in law to protect folks.
Sir, against full disclosure up front, then?
Mr. Chair and members, yes, that's correct.
Okay. Senator Dames, do you have any further? Senator Latz, did you care to comment?
Yeah, I just want to ask how this will affect the remedies section so that I understand how to assess this.
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair and Senator Latz, because they would no longer be exempt from the remedies, it would impact the remedy section. So a mortgage originator, a person with a mortgage originator's license who would perform loan modification services for a fee and who would violate any of the provisions of the statutes would then be subject to the remedies.
And what
we're
are
not
those?
Changing the remedies, are we? Or?
Mr. Chair, no, we're not changing any of the remedies.
Okay. And what do those remedies consist of?
I don't know.
Mr. Chair and Senator Latz, it would simply be the ability to have a private right of action to and I'm not exactly sure if it's actual damage or statutory damages. I'd have to go back and look at the statute. I don't know off the top of my head, but there is it's a civil remedies a provision, a private right for violation of sections 325N01 through 09.
Mr. Chairman, just at first blush, I think I won't request the bill at this time, but I will ask
why don't you reserve
Judiciary we'll, Council to take a look at it as well. And if you think there's any need
I
to
think
see
we're going
to,
with that in mind, we'll move it now to the floor, but with the understanding that Senator Latz is going to look at it and he can pull it back on the floor if need be. Is that correct? So on that motion, Senator Dahl moves that Senate File 294 be recommended to pass as amended. Be recommended to pass and sent to the Minnesota Senate floor. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Thank you very much, folks.
Thank you, committee.
Senator Rest, I see you in the audience. You've got Senate File 86, Board of Accountants, and welcome to the Commerce Committee. And you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Senate File 86 comes at the recommendation of the Board of Accountancy, changing some of the statutes which apply to the practice of certified public accountants. And the reason why it comes here is because some of the implications of the bills affects consumer protection. And in particular, in the section of the bill where we are changing the, it's not explicit, but where we are proposing to change the fees that are paid by certified public accountants and CPA firms. First of all, we're moving those from the rules to the statute, and then with the support of the CPA Society and Minnesota Society of CPAs and the Board of Accountancy, so that a couple of things can be accomplished. The next stop of the bill would be the Committee on Finance going to the State Department and Veterans Affairs Division, which has jurisdiction over the Board of Accountancy's budget. So if you look at just what's being proposed in terms of the fees, It's in Section 4. And then the rationale for that is in just like a number of collection points of fees and other things that are supposed to service the licensing function of a given professional license. Sometimes not all those dollars go into the board, and they go elsewhere. In this case, as you know, smiling,
they go
in the general fund. There are requests for the appropriation. We don't have the appropriation section in here. That would be attached in the State Department's bill. But what they're looking for, and again, in terms of consumer interests and protection, is two FTEs will be asking for, including an additional investigator. They're very short on that right now. And also joining and being a much more active partner in the National Association of State Boards of Accountancy's database, where consumers would be able to access actions that have been taken against CPAs by their state boards of accountancies. We did have a provision that committee's permission that this is not the first stop, but it would be very helpful to us. What we had done in the bill, trying to streamline things, was to have reinstate an annual license for CPAs and to have their CPE requirements met within the same time period, but that turns out to be problematic, and so we are proposing to keep the same law with regard to reporting CPEs, which would make it on a fiscal year, July 1, but then change the license to an annual license. So,
Senator Resch, you just explained the
A2 amendment. If that could be adopted, it just changes the CPE reporting back to current law.
The date, yeah, I understand it. Senator Ryder, do you move the A2 amendment?
I do, Mr. Chair.
All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those, motion prevails. Do you have a couple of witnesses there?
We do, if you have any.
I think we could be very brief.
Do you have
I think
any
everybody's
questions?
On board.
Yeah. If you have any questions, fine. They're here from
unless the committee has
the State
questions.
Board of
I think we're
it's talked pretty
to
straightforward.
A couple of your witnesses a couple of times myself, and I'm comfortable with it. But
thank
Senator
you, Mr.
Brown.
Chairman.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Ress, I'm just curious, are these all new fees or are these fee increases or
what Senator Brown, if you look at, I believe it's Section 4.
Mm-hmm.
The fees, not only are most of these not new, some of them are over 30 years at this level, and but they have been contained in the rules rather than in the statute. And so what the Board of Accountancy is proposing is that since they're not changed very often, which is actually the reason you have rules, so that you don't have to come back year after year for statutory changes, is to move them into the statute. And let you know that where the new ones are in section, if you look at page three in Section 4, line 19, the initial issuance of a certificate goes to $150 from $50. The renewal of a certificate, this is now number two, of a certificate with an active status, goes to $100 from $45. All the rest stay the same until down at number 11, the initial registered accounting practitioner firm permits also goes to $100 from $45. And then number 16, at line 4.5, the renewal of certificates with an inactive status is set at $25, up from $15.
Senator Rest,
all the others stay the same.
It seems to me that the people involved here are willing to tax themselves a little more to get the two more people. Is that kind of the case, or
We don't exactly call it a tax.
Oh, you got the plenty fee. Excuse me, Senator Rest. They're willing to raise the fees.
Well, they're willing to raise the fees because it will indeed give better authority to the Board of Accountancy by being able to have an additional investigator when complaints are made by a member of the public about the practice, and also getting involved much more heavily with the NASBA. We have adopted the Uniform Accountancy Act, but getting involved with the that database where it's accessible by the public.
Senator Carlson, what do you call this?
He calls it a fee.
Fee? I saw some of your literature, your brochures during the campaign.
Depends on which side you're talking about.
I know which group you're talking about. Senator Dames or Senator Brown, did you have Mark? Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dames.
Senator Rest, now the increase in the fees, like you gave certain ones here, like number 11, number 16, were these fees annual fees before, or were these 3 year fees every 3 years before, and now going to annual?
There, Mr. Chairman and Senator Dames, are annual fees.
And were they annual before, or were they 3 year?
Annual.
Okay.
Okay. Did we? Yeah, we approved the amendment. Any further discussion on Senate File 86? Senator Reinhart, did you wish to move the bill and it'll be referred to the Finance Committee next? Is that your wish?
Yes, sir.
Exactly what I was going to say, Mr. Chairman.
I knew you were thinking that, yeah. Okay, any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
And it
aye.
Is.
Opposed, motion prevails. Thank you.
And the record
Senator
will reflect
Rest.
That
and
what's amended.
And your witnesses were wonderful. Yeah. You guys did a great job.
Mr. Chairman, the record will reflect that the bill goes to finance as amended in this committee.
Okay.
Correct. Thank you.
That's what Senator Reinhart said.
Exactly. Thank you.
Senator Goodwin, Senate File 316. Surety bond posting requirements for estate sale conductors of Senator Goodwin. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senate File 316 changes current law from absolutely no requirements on people that do estate sales, that conduct estate sales, to have them post a surety bond of up to $20,000. If you look, I think the page is passing out the article that was in the paper last spring on the estate conductor, sale conductors that have not paid paid the people for their property. And oftentimes it's either somebody that's an elderly person that's downsizing and getting rid of almost everything they own, or, of course, somebody that died and the heirs are getting rid of everything they own, and then when they're not paid their portion of the a sale, they are pretty much out of luck. This particular person, Kirkland, has done this in several estate sales, different ones in the state of Minnesota, and he hasn't paid anything back to the people that own the property in the first place. If you do, and there's increasingly more of these estate sales going on, and when they do the estate sale, they usually collect between 30 and 50% of sale. The conductor gets 30 to 50% of the sale. In this case, they're taking 100%, and they're not paying the people that own the property. So all of my bill does is say that they have to post a surety bond for $20,000 with the county, and before they conduct a sale. That should solve most of the problems. $20,000 surety bond isn't going to cover everything, because there's a lot of people that are selling automobiles and big, large items as well, furs and jewelry and all kinds of things. But at least it comes close, and it pretty much is going to cover most people. The cost of a surety bond is depends on the rate at which it depends on a couple of things. It depends on their credit rating, so forth. But the average for a surety bond is 3% of the amount that they'd have to lay down in order to get a surety bond, $20,000.
That's good. Senator, is this, in your opinion, pretty widespread? Or I mean, I know you've got an example in the folder, but I haven't heard much about this personally, and I'm just wondering if, if it's needed, and if there's a people on the other side or anybody. I don't see anybody here, but the Attorney General and the Commerce Department, have they weighed in on this?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, the Attorney General's office is prosecuting this particular person for fraud. As far as widespread, I don't know the answer to that because these folks aren't licensed. So the only way we would know that is if the Attorney General's office got complaints. I do know that unattached to this at all was a neighbor of mine that had an estate sale, and they collected 40%, the conductor did, and that was the cheapest that this family could find to liquidate her home. And it took 3 months to get that payment from the conductor. So that's another thing that we might not hear about, is that they hold on to the money for whatever reason and don't pay it immediately to the heirs or the owner. And by the way, auctioneers are both licensed and have to be bonded, but estate sales conductors do not. And this doesn't license them, but it does bond them.
Senator Kosalko.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Goodwin, so you're saying that the rough estimate on what it would take to buy one of those bonds is about 3%?
Correct.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin, so that's about $600 on. So if you've got somebody that does this for a living, they're going to have to pay $600 for every estate sale that they do. Will they be able to pass that on to the person they're helping make the estate sale to, or how does that end up getting paid in your estimation? Do you think, are they able to charge more to the person that they're doing that service for, or how's that going to work?
Is it a one-time fee, or is it each and every sale? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'd like to ask a counsel.
Mr. Chairman, it looks like it's before you do any of these sales, you have to post a bond in the county. Yeah. And it says it's either the county where the sales take place or the county in which you reside. So I assume that probably be the one they opt to for the most part.
Senator Kosalko.
Thanks. I guess this is the council then, too. So that's an annual fee?
That's a good question. I believe they're priced on an annual basis, surety bonds are. I don't think it's a one-time charge. I think that's correct.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Kosalko, I want to answer your other question, too, on the $600 and they'd have to put down. That's a small amount for the people that do this professionally. It's really not large. And the sales often go $20,000, $30,000, or whatever. But the fact of the matter is that they charge 30 to 50% of the estate right now to arrange the estate sale and then to...
Senator Kosalko.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Goodwin. I just wanted to make sure that wasn't a per estate sale fee, and that's why I asked that question. If it's an annual fee and it's you have all the estate sales you're doing, you're right.
That's an excellent question because it makes it a lot more palatable to at least this member that you're not going to be paying $600 each and every time. That's right. Really costly.
Yes.
Senator Brown, did you, and then Senator Carlson?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Goodwin, I'm looking at lines 1.23 and 1.24, and I'm just curious if this bill will require the estate sale conductors to pay in a certain time. It says if pay all sums required by law or contract. What if they leave that out of the contract, a time frame in which they have to pay the holder of the estate? Is there something in here that requires payment within a certain amount of time?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
And Senator Brown, but it would be, it's a good idea. I would accept a friendly amendment to do that if you so desire, or it's going to judiciary next. So, but I think that's a really good, that would be a really good addition to this, that they did have a certain amount of time they had to pay within.
All right, Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator,
we, and maybe this is something for council, it said that pay all sums required by law or contract and all things conform to the contract and to all laws relevant to the estate sale or to persons who conduct estate sales. And I guess I'm interested in whether this means to pay their employees. Very often, you know, in estate sales, there's people that are asked to come in and estimate the value of certain articles in the estate sale. And I guess in this particular instance, this particular conductor of estate sales is the was hiring one of my constituents and didn't pay him several times.
Mr. Counselor.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carlson, I don't read this as protecting the employees of the estate sale conductor, but as to protecting the parties which the estate sale conductor contracts with to sell their goods. So I don't think, I think it'd be a stretch to extend this language to cover unpaid wage claims for estate sale conductor's employees.
Okay, Senator Kosoka.
Thank you. I'm looking at line 2.4, and it seems to be telling me that the auctioneer also has to have this bond. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct, Senator Gazalka, because right now auctioneers have to be licensed and bonded for auctions, but they wouldn't have to if they conduct an estate sale instead of an auction. Then they wouldn't have to bond for that. But this would say if they're going to also conduct estate sales, which they do oftentimes, then they have to pay the bond as well. But
okay, this has another stop, I'm told, at the Judiciary Committee. And Senator Goodwin, you'd like to move. Did we amend this?
No,
we didn't amend it. Senate File 86. Or excuse me, 361, you recommended to pass and forward it to the Judiciary Committee. Is that your motion?
Yeah,
all those in favor, well, signify by saying aye.
I just wanted to say,
okay, yeah,
Mr. Chair, that it's 316, just to correct the number.
316, yes.
Okay, thank you.
We got that. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails.
Thank you, members and Mr. Chair.
I think that does it for the committee today. We're not meeting Wednesday, so we get a little break there. And with that, the Commerce Committee is adjourned.